Doobity-bity-boop-boo. Hello, everybody, and welcome. If you are listening in to The Department Live, I'm still waiting for Phil to come on air, but he should be here shortly. In the meantime, what's today's episode going to be about? Well, it's going to be about wellness in academia. How can we include an attentiveness to wellness and well-being into our daily academic practices? What strategies work to reduce stress while fostering positive relationships? And how can we encourage a culture of wellness and well-being to nurture academic success? Join us to discuss all things wellness in academia. And here is our co-host, Phil Primo. Hello, Phil.
Hello, hello, Billy.
So, Phil, how are you doing?
How am I doing? It's often a question that we ask each other, and I am utterly unsure about how to answer it now. So my go-to sort of answer is like, okay.
Okay.
I'm okay, you know?
Are you well, but, Phil?
I'm doing okay.
Fair enough. Well, it's such an interesting word that I think we should dedicate an entire program to it, Phil. What do you reckon?
I think we should as well. As well to do the wellness, but hopefully, okay. So we're going to get to talking about how we don't like that term.
Absolutely, yeah. We're going to take a look at it, and kind of critically engage with this term. Throughout the program. Here we have our second live caller of the show, Alexis Shotwell. You are live on air.
Hello, so good to be here.
Hi, Alexis. How are you doing?
Holding up, as we say in the Maritimes, can't complain. It always has the quality that you would complain if you could, but you can't. But no, I really can't complain. I'm good.
It's really nice to hear you live on air, Alexis.
So good to be here. It's my first time listening to the podcast or being on the podcast, so it's great.
Well, you're very welcome. And in terms of sound, we can hear you absolutely fine. So there's no problems there. So I'd like to officially welcome you to the Department Podcast, Professor Alexis Shotwell from the Department of Anthropology and Sociology.
Thank you. Good to be here officially.
Oh, I was going to say, welcome to the show, Alexis. And Billy, cue the music.
We want to acknowledge that Carleton University and the other locations where we make this podcast are on traditional, unceded Algonquin territory.
Welcome, everybody, to another live episode of the Department Podcast. My name is Billy Flynn, and today I'm joined by our producer and co-host, Phil Primo.
Welcome, 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 everyone. On today's episode, we have a special guest, Alexis Shotwell from the Department of Sociology and Anthropology, who will be joining us to discuss all things wellness and academia. Now we use the term wellness kind of loosely here, Billy, and I want to start, we can discuss our shared acknowledgement that we don't necessarily like this term before we get going.
It's an interesting term, Phil, and one of the reasons why I asked you, are you well, at the beginning of the show is that it's actually a very familiar question to me.
Yes.
From an Irish context, people regularly ask each other, are you well? So when I hear the term wellness, when I think about how it's used in many different contexts to refer to many different things, I'm a little bit unsure as to what exactly it's referring to in a mental health capacity, because usually I just use it as a way of checking in on someone and asking if they're okay.
So I don't necessarily like the term for that reason. It's kind of ambiguous, but it also sort of signals to me that when we talk about wellness, we're talking about certain things, and hopefully we get into this. But Alexis, I wanted to ask you, do you like the term wellness, or what are your thoughts about using the word wellness given our current environment?
Hmm. Well, I think we can say that there's a difference between the idea of being well and the idea of wellness. So wellness is a state that usually has been articulated with the wellness industry. So that's that might be a slightly different way to think about what we're asking and what we're answering. I think one of the interesting things for us to look at is the way that all of these terms cycle, and we become dissatisfied with one, or we critique it, and then another term comes up. So I think in this case, there was a critique that you're both probably familiar with of the term health, that came from a bunch of different places, but in particular, there was a collection that a lot of people read a couple of years ago called Against Health, which forwarded this idea of healthism, so that you became morally responsible for problems that were making you sick that actually are systemic. So this is the kind of thing that happens when people are, you know, get sick with cancer, and so the first thing that someone asks is like, well, did you smoke? Did you eat well? Were you positive?
Right.
Were you cheerful? Right. You know?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to bring into the discussion is a Science Magazine article. Now, they've been pushing out articles and since September now, talking about wellness and mental health in academia. And one of their more recent ones is titled, Professors Must Support the Mental Health of Trainees During the COVID-19 Crisis. Now, on the surface, it sounds like something that we'd be interested in, right? How can professors support the mental well-being and mental health of students, trainees, etc.? But the list of recommendations reads as usual. So it's things like promote more sleep, promote getting more exercise, promote doing the things that most of us already know that we don't do enough of. Now, the discussion that I would like to have gears more towards the sort of institutional characteristics, the sort of ways in which academia is set up currently that either fosters or doesn't foster mental health and mental well-being. And I'd like, we'll toss it back over to Alexis in a little about this, but is there a way that we could be kinder, gentler in academia?
To each other, to ourselves, and to the students, I think. It's kind of hard, actually, because I don't think it's a choice, even though we can, like, there, of course, we can make choices to, you know, change things and do things differently. But I actually don't think it's up to me, in a sense, because basically, when you're talking about dealing with systemic problems and you talk about all these different strains put on students, right, for a variety of different reasons, then I can certainly do my best to try to ameliorate any sort of negative mental health impacts on students from, say, you know, too much course load, financial stress, just, you know, various kind of light stuff. But at the end of the day, it requires not just institutional change, but actually social change, right? Because increasingly university degrees are being university programs and degrees are being used more as sort of just kind of production factories for the job market. And I think that's having a negative, that's problematic from the point of view of students' mental health and also from an educational point of view. That's what I have to say about that, Phil.
Alexis, would you like to talk a little bit about the institutional dynamics of wellness?
So I totally agree with Billy, right? That if we just shift the individualizing imperative from the students, like you should sleep more and exercise more and eat better, and then you'll be able to better manage, you know, neoliberalism, to professors, you should be nicer. That's not actually changing that individualizing move very much. So definitely we need to have big transformation around things like tuition and the entire structure of grading and credentialing and, you know, all of the things that we know. I guess I think about it, though, in terms that are kind of like survival pending revolution. So how can we build, so that's a phrase from the Black Panther Party. And they were, you know, completely right about needing to keep people alive and connected, and like alive, not just in the sense of subsisting, physically subsisting, but alive to their life, you know, alive to the meaning of their life. And I think there are a lot of things that we can do as professors to create more of that, and that students can do while this is the situation we're in. So I'll just give you one example from my class and what happened from it, if that's okay. Absolutely. So I am teaching I'm teaching a social justice in action class. And so one of the things that I did was part of the class is topical. And in the summer, when I was setting it up, I surveyed the students who were enrolled then and said, which of these things that I am prepared to teach are you excited to learn about? And all of the people who responded were excited to learn about abolitionism, you know, the move to defund the police or get rid of prisons. And so that's what we've been focusing on. And in the class, I'm doing a thing called specs grading, which is basically that there's 160 points available and you just pick how many points you want to do. And all of the assignments are marked satisfactory or unsatisfactory. So you still get a grade at the end of the class, but you just do the assignments you want, and you can redo them as many times as it takes to get a satisfactory mark. And at first this was really confusing, you know, it's not normal. And then now people are really like it, and say that it changes the way that they feel about doing the assignment. One of the strands of assignments are called capacity building. So when we're studying about how do you learn about social movements, we've also been doing things that you need to be able to do if you're engaged in changing society, like have a good conversation with someone that you disagree with. So over the reading break, I gave as an assignment, one of the capacity assignments was take 2 days off and do things that you find joyful and replenishing. And tell me how it went. And so it was like, you get a little bit of points for that. Also like a really interesting assignment in the class where we're talking about, when we're talking about people being punished for basically being poor, right? The criminalization of poverty, and the way that that's about a moralism that you always have to be working if you're going to be a good person, or you should be punished and go to jail. So it was fascinating. And what was really sad was that every single one of the students said, I would never have done this over reading week if you hadn't made it an assignment. And it was really good for me, you know, variations of that.
Couples, and it builds on, I think, a few different elements that I feel are part of a kinder, gentler academia, and that is like including choice and perceiving students and young people as empowered to make choices about their learning. I feel like often the way that courses are set up is that it sort of dictates the moves and the small moves that happen in a student's journey and learning for that assignment. But including choice allows students to be empowered. So giving choice about what you learn, how you learn it, how many points even are assigned to a learning module or something like that, I think allows us to build in empowerment strategies in a kinder sort of way. Billy, do you have any sort of thoughts or experience about allowing students choice in courses?
You know, I'm always somebody who tries to give tries to recognize that giving students flexibility is probably the most compassionate way, right? Because it does allow them to figure things out on their own time schedule and their own kind of life things. So I'm all for that, especially in terms of deadlines and stuff like that as well, right? And I think one of the interesting things that Alexis talked about was how she seems to be using assignments as ways through which to actually bring about this kind of broader structural change, if I understood what she was saying correctly. In other words, that it's not just about what a prof does to with an individual student, but it's the kind of assignments that you can actually assign in classes to get students to think about the kind of material conditions and institutional conditions of their life as well. So I found what Alexis was saying in relation to assignments and wellness kind of an interesting sort of way of approaching that in relation to choice and how many students chose to do that assignment versus who actually didn't choose to do it over the reading break as well.
It's also about, do we see each other as people? Or do we see each other as adversaries? And there's something that changes when we see other classmates as comrades, and when we see the like faculty-student relationship as also something that, there's something different when faculty see students not as like grifters and malingerers, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
That connects to wellness.
So, I mean, it's kind of many things. So, Alexis, in terms of the different types of relationships that you've mentioned as well, right? It's also what you seem to be saying is what faculty bring into the class as well, and their own perceptions about students and their own, you know, preconceptions as well, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah, I mean, there was an article that was going around, a blog post that was going around a while ago that said, it basically was like, eliminate cop shit in the classroom. So as we move into the coronavirus and being online, there's lots of opportunities for faculty to be punitive and surveil their students. And that's really different than we can choose not to use those features. So it means choosing not to give the exams that track whether your student is looking away from their screen for a certain amount of time. There's all these things that we know vastly increase student stress. And I've found it transformative to just assume that every student I'm interacting with is genuinely trying and wants to be there and an adult. Might not be true for everyone, but I know that I have students this term who are single parents of many children, other students who's had a parent in hospital for 5 weeks who then died. And I know there are other things like that happening for the rest of my students, and I just don't know it. So, yeah, this is maybe more about faculty and what we can do to make life less horrible for students. And maybe we should turn to be thinking about how students can push back against the horror stress thing that is so hard.
You know, I'm really glad that you brought up, the faculty-student sort of relationship, and particularly the word stress. I'm gonna come back to something that I know Alexis and I have spoken about, and I'm gonna bring you into the loop, Billy. Inside Higher Ed published a kind of a review of a book called The Slow Professor. And they start the article by saying in 2013, the jobs website CareerCast named university professors the number one least stressful job. Now, you can imagine that there was like you know, a tsunami or a torrent of criticism about that. So they re-released the poll in 2016, and they listed tenured university professors as the number three least stressful job, again, to a torrent of criticism. Now, the landscape has changed significantly since 2016 as we move to virtual online learning. But the message found in the Slow Professor, one that argues that professors should actively resist the culture of speed of academia, I think becomes something of value for us as a message, maybe something that we can reflect upon. Billy, do you know this book, The Slow Professor?
I've heard of it. I haven't read it, Phil, but I know that it's a very well-known and well-spoken about, maybe not well-spoken about, but much discussed book in academia in terms of talking about the pace at which we learn and the pace at which we set our students to learn as well. I haven't read it, so I can't speak to that directly, Phil, but I believe you've read it and Alexis has read it as well. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's written by Maggie Berg, professor of English at Queen's University in Canada, and Barbara K. Sieber, also professor of English at Brock University. And just to give our listeners a little sort of insight into some of the things that are discussed in that book, this is a quote, "While slowness has been celebrated in architecture, urban life, and personal relations, it has not yet found its way into education." And the book extols the virtues of going slow and not really following the sort of production line model in academia. But Alexis, I don't feel that the book or the movement offers all the answers to how we can be gentler, kindler in academia.
Yeah, no. I think a lot of what the book did really helpfully was spark generative critique, you know. And one of the things that I'm really interested in, and the most widespread critique of that book was that it's advice that can apply to people after they've gotten tenure and maybe promoted a couple of times.
Right.
Yeah. And there's this book that I think we've talked about, Phil, called Disciplined Minds, Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Sucking System that Shapes Their Lives.
Which, I like the sound of that title.
Kind of a great title.
It's a great book. And it looks at the ways that people who undertake professional training become this weird thing where if you're a professional who has a salary relative to other workers, you have so much more freedom than a worker who has to punch in and has a manager who's looking at your hourly work. But therefore, professionalizing programs create people who are not going to use that freedom to overturn the system that has credentialed them. So I think that claim is just right, that if faculty wait until they're full professors to start doing something they care about, they're never going to know what they care about, because they always will have been engaging with their work in a instrumental way where they didn't follow the things that they cared about, and they didn't take stands that mattered in order to try to keep having a job. So having a job is really important, but academics, and I think that this goes back to undergrads actually, there's this term in library studies that is vocational awe. So it's the idea that you can have a vocation, like being a librarian, being a scholar, but if you have vocational awe about something, you're less able to question the things that are bad about the system that you're involved in. So the answer to that is to develop our curiosity and to practice being passionately committed to things now, not later.
Right.
And that's actually like in a lot of the texts that I read, that's also the answer to individualized wellness regimens of self-care. So instead of resting more, although resting is important, the thing that you do to combat burnout is build curiosity.
Okay. That's an unusual solution, but it's an intriguing one.
I know.
At first, it almost sounds counterintuitive, right? Like when we think of burnout, the remedy to that is to not do anything. But this suggestion is to actually find things that are nurturing, things that you care about and that you're inquisitive about, and focus on those instead.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose part of that is the whole kind of career thing, isn't it? You know, in terms of the path that people find themselves on and the speed at which they want to kind of go down that path as well.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what your experience of this is, Billy, but having watched myself and a lot of students, one thing I observe is that as soon as I or others start doing things because we think it's the like conventional thing or the thing that will get us through quickly.
Right.
There's a quality of becoming dead to our own work that tends to mean that people have a really hard time doing stuff. So it's a different question to ask, like, what makes me feel alive to my life? And that's, you know, this is the existential question, right? We don't actually want to not feel alive in our life. That really causes us to burn out.
Right.
So it's not just about what depletes us.
Yeah.
It's about what replenishes us. And that's joy.
I think we're getting into some fairly profound structural kind of existential connections there, though, when we begin to talk about alienation, right, and our species being, to use Marx's term. And well, I didn't expect to go this deep into talking about wellness today, Phil and Alexis, I must say.
My experience for the past, I don't know, how long have we known each other, Alexis? Number of years, anyway.
5 years?
Yeah, at least 5 years, yeah. Has been, I never know where the conversation is going to go, but at the end it always goes somewhere meaningful and somewhere where it needed to go, if that makes any sense.
That is my experience of you too.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for joining us today on the Department Live, Alexis. It's really been a pleasure having you.
So good to be here. Sorry, Alexis, for my tech difficulties.
No, thanks so much. And it's been great just chatting with you, right, about all things academic and all things human as well. I'm going to give you a cheer for my audio sound effects, Alexis.
Yeah, we got to do that.
There you go. Give you a round of applause there as well, Alexis.
Yeah.
Put a smile on the face for today.
All right.
No worries.
All right.
Thanks very much, Alexis. Good to hear from you.
Bye.
If you'd like to comment on some of the things that we've discussed today, you can find us on Twitter at DepartmentPod. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and a bunch more podcast apps where you can listen to past episodes. And you can send us an email at info@departmentpodcast.ca. We'd really love to hear from you. We really hope that you spend a few minutes, send us your questions for segments. What do you want to hear? What do you want us to talk about? Or maybe you have something to say about sociology, anthropology, higher education, or your own take on wellness in academia. Maybe you're a grad student, an undergrad, and you'd like to learn how you can involve yourself in wellness strategies with students or faculty. Also, a big thanks to Carleton's University Department of Sociology and Anthropology for sponsoring this podcast. There are amazing, great things happening in the department, so I'm really proud to be part of it. And I'm really happy that we have the institutional and financial support to continue on with this podcast.
It's been really nice chatting with you again and with Alexis on another episode of The Department. So until next time, folks, I'm going to say goodbye.
And hey, thanks for listening.